From the beginning. Welcome to everyone to the Narcisse Bible study. It is the 8th of June, just before Erev Shavuot, the entrance of Feast of Weeks holiday, or Shavuot in Hebrew, or if you want, Pentecost in English via Greek. So, if you've checked the website, we're taking a break from our regular triennial parasha, and we're going to be reading Ruth in light of in light of the Shavuot holiday. Does everyone know the standard reading system? Like the five scrolls are read during the various holidays throughout the year. So during Passover, you read Song of Solomon. Shavuot, you read Ruth. So, why? Tell me why.
Curses.
Gleaning. Did I hear gleaning?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, good. Gleaning.
It's, and it's not just the gleaning, it's the harvest of...
The wheat harvest.
It is the wheat harvest. Okay. So, yeah. Hi, welcome. So, as we read, we might have to condense our reading so we can also actually discuss something. But yes, wheat harvest is the main thing. If you look at, say, you can turn to Exodus 34:22. Exodus 34:22. You must observe the Feast of Weeks, the first fruits of the harvest of wheat, and the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year. Feast of Ingathering would be parallel to Sukkot. So that's the end of the wheat harvest. So this is essentially the beginning. First fruits of the harvest of wheat. And of course, this is one of the three holidays where, according to the book of Deuteronomy, you need to come to the place God will choose to put his name, which is Jerusalem. So it's one of the three pilgrimage holidays. Hi, welcome. So first, fruits. The other great thing, if you study the holidays in the Bible, I mentioned this before, but it's neat that you have, a lot of the holidays have an element that is celebrating the agricultural year. So it's cyclical. Every year you're going to have the same thing, based on when the rains come, when the harvest is. So like you have these, and years are cyclical, right? You have one time to do whatever. But it also correlates to events on a historical line, which is, you know, like that. This day you came out of Egypt. That was a one-time event. And so it's neat that a lot of these holidays, they're celebrating both the agricultural cycle and a one-time historic event in the salvation story. So what, in light of that, what else does Shavuot celebrate? We just talked about the wheat harvest, which would be this agricultural cycle. What is a one-time historical event in the salvation story of the people of Israel does Shavuot celebrate?
And according to Jewish tradition, it's the giving of the law on Sinai.
Yes, yes it is.
It's quite hard to find it, but it's there, I think, buried.
How do you find it?
Well, I think it comes in...
It goes back to another event. When is Pesach? You could say on the agricultural cycle, Pesach is the lambing time, maybe, when little lambs are born. And it's, let's see, is it just before, it's either barley or just before barley?
I was going
to say barley. Pesach is barley, yes.
Barley, barley harvest, which is, in this land, comes before the wheat harvest.
Right.
But from Pesach, how long between Pesach is Shavuot?
50 days.
50 days, which is how many months?
Two and a half, three.
Well, there's 30 days in a month, yeah, so...
3 days in a month.
What, just short of 2 months.
Just short.
If you follow leaving Egypt, two months-ish from when you're leaving Egypt, where are you at?
Sinai.
So fitting together these events, if you are using Pesach as a starting point, Shavuot is celebrating... let's put it here, another tangent. Sinai. So Pesach, sometimes the agricultural aspect of Pesach maybe is not as emphasized, but it's when you get rid of all your old wheat and you have nothing and you have a new starter for your bread and you start a new wheat or a new grain. You haven't actually gotten to the wheat new harvest yet.
So that's linked with the whole
unleavened
bread.
And it's at the time of the year where you have little lambs, maybe. It's springtime.
I'm thinking agriculturally about the wheat. I'd never thought about that, that you're getting rid of your old stuff, which is tantamount to saying...
Yeah, your old yeast, your old starter.
It's the unleavened bread.
Right, and then you have a week of nothing unleavened, everything cleans out, and then you start your new.
Wow, yeah.
Which is actually, sorry, I used wheat, and I was thinking just flour. It's not wheat yet, it's barley. You would be starting with barley, because that's what's harvested first. And then when you get to Shavuot, you have your first fruits of wheat. Okay, so one other, might as well look at also Deuteronomy 16, 9 through 17. I know we've read this more recently. So I can give you a quiz at the end. Deuteronomy 16, chapter 16, verses 9 to 17. Someone want to read that?
You shall count 7 weeks for yourself. You shall begin to count 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the standing grain. Mm-hmm. Then you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God with a tribute of a freewill offering of your hand, which you shall give just as the Lord your God blesses you. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter and your male and female servants and the Levite who is in your town, and the stranger and the orphan and the widow who are in your midst, in the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name. You shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and you shall be careful to observe these statutes. You shall celebrate... Keep going.
Did you get to 17?
Yeah, she now goes into tabernacles.
Celebrate the Feast of Booths 7 days after you've gathered in from your threshing floor and your wine vat. And you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter, and your male and female servants, and the Levite, and the stranger and the orphan, and the widow who are in your towns. 7 days you shall celebrate the feast of the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you will be altogether joyful. 3 times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and at the Feast of Weeks, and at the Feast of Booths, and they shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which he has given you.
Okay. What does it mean to appear empty-handed?
Bring an offering.
Okay, well, the offerings are prescribed, right? That's part of the holiday, is you have an offering. But then, God's saying, bring... It's kind of like the concept we talk about tithes and offerings. Like, bring what you required, but then bring something else.
But according, what's required is the tithe.
Right, so in this sense, what's required, there's a list of offerings that are required. Let's say a lamb per family. But then bring something else.
Right.
Bring some extra, I don't know. So this idea of abundance. I had us read several of those holidays to give us a feel. What is a emphasis for Deuteronomy. I mean, obviously, he wants us to know that we need to come to Jerusalem 3 times a year, at least a male representative of the family. What else do you pick up as we read through these verses? What's important to Deuteronomy?
This is for everyone, like your son, your daughter, your male and female servant, stranger, orphan, mm-hmm. widow.
So, what is the common denominator between widows, strangers, orphans, and Levites?
They don't have land, they don't have an inheritance.
They don't own property.
They don't own property, specifically land. I mean, we're talking about agriculture here. We're talking about subsistence farming. Everybody in the country lives this way. Yeah, if someone would have a something, hold on. Most obliged. Thank you. Just the corner. I think that should be okay. I spilled my coffee for those in the recording. Getting too excited. So everybody's living off of the land. If you don't have land, if you don't have somewhere, it's like you don't have food. You're dependent on someone else. So Levites don't have food. They're living in the cities. God told them he's the inheritance. They're supposed to be living off of the tithes of everybody else. So if other people aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, they're very poor. And it seems, hints in the text through history, Levites were very poor. Because guess what? People don't like to tithe. Not much has changed. So Deuteronomy really cares that everybody is taken care of. And even in holidays, you specifically go out of your way to include everyone on the margins of society. So whether they be foreign residents, you could say immigrants. Ger, again, is a foreigner who is living in the land. It's more of a long-term status as opposed to nochri, who is just a foreigner. They could be coming in for business and leaving again next week. So the ger is someone who's living with you, but not originally an Israelite. So you can call it a foreign resident, an immigrant, I don't know. And orphans, widows, all that. So just look quickly at Leviticus 19:9. This is not specifically connected to Shavuot, but in a way maybe. Leviticus 19, verse 9.
When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. And you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God.
Right. So this is the concept of leaving a little bit. Don't worry about the little stuff. Let that go to other people. So like if you're baking a cake, you don't need to scrape the bowl perfectly. Just give the leftover scrapings to a kid who wants to lick it. It's kind of like that concept that I have a hard time doing. I scrape every now and then. So again, leave the edges for people. And this is restated in chapter 23, verse 22. By the way, we're in Leviticus. This is in the Holiness Code. These chapters of Leviticus, they talk about be holy because I'm holy, I'm the Lord your God. And it has a specific tone. People identify it as a little mini chunk of the book. And one of the unique things of it is it mixes ritual law with moral law. And so each thing is just as important. You know, yes, you have to do this and this on the ritual side, but then they'll mention all these moral things that, and kind of combine them so that you understand that they're both important. Okay, what did I tell you? Leviticus 23? 22. Who wants to read it?
When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God.
Okay. So usually when there's a law that's difficult to do, you get this, I'm the Lord your God. Kind of like, remember, I'm watching. You better do this. Difficult to do or difficult to enforce. How can you enforce this? Like, leave it for the poor and the alien. The poor by nature cannot defend their own status because they don't have power. The alien has no power. And so it's really up to God to defend them because there's nothing in the society. I mean, this is still true today. You know, poor people can't defend themselves without help from someone else who has more status or more power, whether it's financial power or status, societal power. Pe'ah. What is a pe'ah? Anybody know today what a pe'ah is?
Corners,
yeah. So it's a when you're not supposed to shave the corners of your beard. It's pe'ah. So pe'ot today, if you see Orthodox Jews that have like little ringlets, that's considered the pe'ah here. Don't shave to the corners. No, there's another scripture for that. But yeah, it's a scripture that says don't cut the edges of your beard. So here, though, it actually functions as part of a system that would be generous to the poor. And this, I don't know.
So
it separates them from Egyptians. The weird thing is in Egypt, it seems to be they like to shave the whole. They kind of thought that a completely shaved face was the ideal, except the pharaohs would wear a fake beard. They had like in the hieroglyphs, you'll see, I don't know if it's made out of wood or something, where there's a little beard, like a goatee, but it looks like they're clean shaven and then they add on a little beard. Sorry?
They shave their...
Yes, the priests would shave their head like this. So it's interesting because sometimes in the Bible we don't have a complete picture of what they're seeking to separate from. We only guess between the lines. You know, don't do it like this like the Egyptians do. And we don't have a picture of what they actually did. So we don't know exactly what that meant. But as Judaism has done, just in case, let's not cut it at all. Because we really don't want to break that law. We don't know what it meant. So let's just not do anything and then we're okay. So it's a way of being super careful.
But there are fairly specific things about not shaving your head.
Sure,
and
I mean...
not putting on tattoos and things
sure,
like that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it depends what context. I mean, shaving could also be, it's a disgrace. Remember the men that were captured and they got half their beard shaved, half their head? It was considered a shame, just culturally in general.
Right.
But then there may be more specific shavings, for instance, Egyptian priests, or maybe Baal.
Right.
I mean, we have, again, we read between the lines because we don't have the Bible of the Canaanites, or maybe we're closer in the Egyptians, but, you know, you piece things together with what you know of the culture that was behind it. And that's only so that you understand what they're trying to separate from. Because in our world today, you know, everything has different meanings. And it doesn't necessarily mean exactly the same thing. So shaving your hair today, if you're a guy and shave your hair, it doesn't mean anything of what it meant then. Certainly not a shameful thing. Most of this country shaves their hair because they're going bald. And it's like, it looks better than just having a little bit like this to just shave it all off. It's a trend, I don't know. But we digress. Back to Shavuot.
But all these verses, which is about reaping the harvest and leaving gleanings for the poor, whatever, links directly with Ruth.
Sure. Well, yeah, so this is the backdrop of Ruth, because one question I have for you is, why was Ruth written, and why was it written the way it was written? So let's go to Ruth now. And I think we're going to skip, for the sake of time. Who can summarize for me chapter one?
Of Ruth.
Go ahead.
So there's a woman with two sons and a husband and two daughter-in-laws she moved through Moab. Mm-hmm. Her son's married there, that's where she gets the daughter-in-law. Then her husband and both her sons die. Right. So things are really bad. She hears there was a famine in Israel, which is why she moved. She hears things are better there, decides to go back. Tells both the daughter-in-laws, you don't have to come with me. Mm-hmm. The first daughter-in-law's like, okay, I'll go home. And the second daughter-in-law basically is very persistent. I won't leave you. I will follow you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. And Naomi tries everything to get her not to come. She refuses to not come. And so the two of them go back to Israel together.
Great. Wonderful. I'll point out Orpah. You know the name Orpah?
The one who went back.
Yeah. Do you know what an Oref is? It's the right here. So if you turn your Oref, you're leaving, you're going away. So it happens to fit her name.
Is that?
I want to say about Orpah, that would be the normal thing. Don't think of her as bad. She's just normal. Okay? Ruth is exceptional. So it's not like Ruth is good, Orpah is bad. It's like Orpah is expected and normal. Ruth is exceptional. And why do I say she's exceptional? Well, exactly what Noemi says. Noemi has no way of supporting Ruth at all. So it would be a much better decision financially, economically, if Ruth went back to her house. Someone, one of her relatives is going to take care of her. But if she goes back with Noemi, Noemi is already a widow. She's already in the category of socially disenfranchised with no one to help her. So Ruth is joining a homeless person kind of thing. It's not stable at all. But the flip of that, because Ruth is younger, she would be the one person that maybe would be able to help Noemi in physical labor and possibly marrying again, that kind of thing. So she actually, it's Ruth's grace to Noemi to want to help her. So she's forfeiting her own security for the chance of being able to help Noemi in her security. So it's a very big decision. It's a huge thing for her to do. Okay, so now we go to chapter 2. Let's start in verse 22 of chapter 1. Maybe, Gemma, you can read some verses and we'll read through chapter 2 like this.
So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess and her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. That was Pesach, basically.
There you go. Yeah, barley harvest.
There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. So Ruth the Moabitess says to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him, in whose sight I may find favor. And she said, go, my daughter. And she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered him, the Lord bless you. Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? So the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered and said, it's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house.
Then Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young woman. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young man not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young man had drawn. Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?
And that is a Nohri there, by the way.
Do you have it in English?
Very
yes.
Important.
Yeah.
Go ahead and read a couple of verses. We can just carry on reading through chapter 2.
Boaz replied, I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with the people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be literally rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord, she said. You have given me comfort and have spoken kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servant gods.
And Milcom Boaz said to her, come here that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasting grain, and she ate and was satisfied and had some left. When she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servant, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. Also, you shall purposely pull out the same grain from the bundles and leave it, that she may glean, and do not rebuke her.
Do not rebuke her, is that what you said?
Yeah.
So she gleaned in the field until evening and read our and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she brought forth and gave to her that she had reserved after she was sufficed. And her mother-in-law said unto her, where hast thou gleaned today, and where proudest thou lest be he that did take knowledge of thee? And she shewed her mother-in-law with whom she had wrought, and said, the man's name with whom I wrought on today is Boaz.
And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Naomi also said to her, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. And Ruth the Moabite said, behold, besides, he said to me, you shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.
And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with this young woman, with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted. So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law.
Okay, so with a nice little story, they come back, barley, and then she gleans all the way to the end of the wheat. So past Shavuot, but certainly during Shavuot. What stands out to you about Ruth in this chapter? Who is Ruth?
She's a hard worker.
She's a hard worker. Who do people perceive her to be? How is she defined when Boaz says, who is this girl over here? What do they say?
She's supposed to be a foreigner. They see that.
Specifically what?
But particularly because she always does.
Moabite.
She's a Moabite, but the way she respects her mother.
If
in-law.
If you notice in this story, Ruth is constantly called Ruth the Moabitess. Ruth the Moabitess. Okay, so if you ever study literature, especially literature like the Bible that is very careful with words, it's not very verbose, you pay attention to repetitions like this. If it's telling you seven times Ruth is a Moabitess, it doesn't need to, right? It could tell you that one time. So why? Why is it telling you Ruth the Moabitess, Ruth the Moabitess?
Well, all these repetitions.
What's it trying to prove?
So that she's a Gentile.
She's
and it's really important to notice.
She's not part of Israel.
She's not part of Israel, so that's a big thing. But even more than that, I would say.
Is she an important person for Moabites? Like, maybe she has some kind of...
Okay, so first of all, Ruth coming into Israel, she's a foreigner. She's a Moabite. She is a widow. She is an orphan too, because she just left, functionally, she left her family. So orphan, widow, foreigner, all rolled into one. And on top of that,
and
a Moabite.
From an enemy nation.
An enemy nation, and here's what you need to feel, is, you know, people groups, they have feelings about each other. Where is the first story of the Moabites?
When they came out of Egypt, they attacked them.
Okay, before that,
Lot.
What is Lot? There you go. Genesis 19.
Yeah.
And when you read the story in Genesis 19, would you say it's a good story, bad story? What's your impression? You know what story I'm talking about? Lot and his daughters just escape Sodom and Gomorrah. They run to the hills. The daughters say, there are no men left in the world. And so we need to use our father to get offspring. So what should we do to him? How are we going to do this? What's
sleep
your plan?
Him.
Yeah, but how?
Get him drunk.
Get him drunk. Sleep with him and get offspring that way. And so the two people group that come out of this incestuous relationship are Moab and Ammon. Ben Ammi. Am is a word for people group, but it can also be like grandfather. So in the story, Ben Ammi would be the son of his grandfather. Moab, if you take it in a more Moabite pronunciation, it would be Me'av, from the father. So both of them, there's a play on their name, connecting it to incest. So even in the very beginning of their people, according to the Israelite tradition, they are bad. They're incestuous, right? So you say, okay, fine, that was way back then, in the beginning, they were born in incest, so what? But this reputation stays with them. Go to Numbers. Where are we going to? Numbers 25. So this is in the wilderness. The people are in the wilderness. This is just during, we've just had the incident of Balaam. And if you remember Balak, who was the king of Moab, he wanted to curse Israel. And so he hired this itinerant prophet to come curse. And the prophet said, I can only say what God gives me to say. And he ends up blessing them. And so you don't have it written, but in between the lines, they're still trying to figure out a way to get this big, great, powerful nation on their doorstep to fail. And so the very next verse, you have Numbers 25. What does it say?
They went to commit harlotry with the women of Moab.
Okay. So,
they
Israelites the living in Shittim, and they began to...
I've got commit harlotry.
Commit harlotry, commit sexual immorality, liznot. That is anything outside of marriage, any sexual outside of marriage that's wrong, particularly for girls. guys can do it too. So here, the Moabite women, there's like a stereotype of them being basically prostitutes. And not just any prostitute, idolatrous prostitutes. So,
they're not the Christian prostitutes.
Well, it's like two big laws being broken at once, right? It's not just that it's sexually promiscuous. It's that it's idolatrous. And in fact, there's Jewish interpretation that would read between the lines here that when Balaam wasn't able to curse them for Balak, he said, well, you know, there is one way you could get at them. If they break their own covenant with God, then that leaves them vulnerable. So why don't you send in your women and kind of coax them to be led astray and worship other gods?
It actually says it, doesn't it? They invited the people to the sacrifices
they
of their gods, and the people
yeah.
ate and bowed down to their gods. So
yeah.
Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. It's pretty heavy duty stuff.
This is a huge event in the memory of Israel. This sin, referred to as Baal Peor, because that's where it happened. How people in mass were led astray, and there was a plague that broke out. There was some serious punishment. You find reference to this even in the book of Hosea, who's probably he's a northern prophet in like the 8th century BC, of course. So, again, what is your impression of a Moabitess?
Prostitute.
The people group started in incest. They're prostitutes. They come to lead you astray. Mm-hmm. They're seductresses that are out to get you. Right? That's the stereotype. And now we have Ruth. And the author is not sweeping the fact that she's a Moabite under the rug. He's putting it front and center. Ruth's a Moabite. She's a Moabite. She's a Moabite. Don't forget, she is a Moabite. So he's definitely, he or she, whoever's writing the book, is definitely wanting you to think about the stories of the Moabites. And that is because you need, if you want to justify someone, you need to bring up all the evidence and present it. You can't hide things away. And so he is dealing with this head on. Yes, Ruth is a Moabitess, but watch her. So, back to Ruth. We're going to read.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing.
Because then she is this Moabite, she's this Moabite, and she actually says the three things which...
Your people will be my people,
your God,
my God. So
yes.
She's doing the opposite.
She's,
instead of luring them to her gods, she's saying, no, I'm going to leave my gods and be stuck to your gods.
Right, but I mean, it's not just the God. It's the land, it's the people, it's everything. I mean, it's like a three-pronged
declaration.
And
by the way, she doesn't use the same word, but what the people of Israel do in Numbers 25 is lehit samed, nitzmad. This is to be stuck to something, like plastic wrap, you know. Ruth does davek, think of devek, glued, to be stuck to something. They're synonyms, right? So it's not the same word, but it's in the same semantic field. So it's interesting that it is kind of the reverse of what the children of Israel did to the Moabite gods.
Yeah.
Now she is doing to the God of Israel and to Naomi. So
amazing,
there is that reversal there. Okay. Now what about Boaz? What's your impression of Boaz? We know that he's a gibor hai. He is a superhero. Gibor is like a big mighty man. Hail is strength. In earlier stories in the Bible, this tends to be the description of someone who's powerful in like battle. Later on, later text tends to use this financially. You can be powerful by being rich, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if Boaz was a big, powerful person, but I'm assuming he was some level of wealthy because he's owning fields and he has a bunch of workers, so he's on some status there.
Do we have any idea if Boaz was actually married? Did he have any kids?
We don't have any idea.
We don't have any idea, do we?
Here's our hint. He blesses her later for choosing him over the younger men.
Yeah.
What does that mean? I don't know. Was he 40? Was he 50? I don't know. So maybe he had a wife who died. Maybe he had other wives. It really doesn't tell us. But Gibor Hayil, I just want to say, you know Proverbs 31, woman?
Yeah.
You know what that is in
Eshet
English?
Hayil.
Eshet Hayil, woman of valor. So he's a man of valor. So in addition to being strong and rich, you can also interpret it to be your character is very good. You're like an exemplary person, right? Just like Proverbs 31, woman is exemplary. She's industrious. She does all this stuff. And so in that sense, he's exemplary. So what does he do that's so impressive in this chapter?
Well, he doesn't judge Ruth from where she came from.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, he knows she's a Moabitess, but he's obviously prepared to, he doesn't say it, but let's wait and see what she's really like. And when he does, he's very kind to her.
And what does he notice about her?
That she's kind to her. She's kind to the, and also she stayed with his women, but behind.
Well,
the
before
women,
that, he says, "I've heard about you, what you did for your mother.
Yes.
Like I see what you did is exceptional. You went out of your way to be kind to somebody, and I'm going to let that inform me more than your stereotype of where you come from. And that's a very difficult thing to do for people because we approach people through what we learn in life through these stereotypes.
Yeah. He also says in verse 12 that like the God of Israel under whose wings you have come to seek refuge,
mm-hmm.
like maybe a recognition of, like he's not assuming seeing her first as a Moabitess, but he's taking her seeking refuge under the God of Israel at face value, maybe?
Yeah, and we have the other passage where a Moabite can't join the assembly of God mm-hmm. until the 10th generation. Some people explain this, well, it says Moavi, male and not female. But I kind of view this as more, there are rules and there are exceptions. And Ruth definitely joins the community of God. And so Boaz is able to see her as that, yes, as her new identity in joining herself to the God of Israel, and that is stronger than her previous identity of being this seductress foreign woman, kind of like everything bad. But, okay, so he, according to the rules we just read in some of these gleaning and wheat harvest, how would you size Boaz up? Is he meeting the law? Is he under the law? Is he over the law?
He's keeping the law
because he says,
leave the
gleaning for her, let her glean. But what does he add to it?
Oh, he also says, stay with my girls.
Yes, and why is that?
Because you're going to get raped if you go off somewhere else.
Fields are dangerous places. If you remember in the biblical law, if a guy catches a girl in the field and sleeps with her, he just has to marry her.
Yeah.
And he can't divorce her, of course. But it's a dangerous place because you are vulnerable. There's nobody around. And especially if you're a foreigner, and especially if people already think you're a prostitute, right?
Yeah.
You would be vulnerable. And so he's going out of his way to protect her, saying, look, I know what could happen to you, and I'm trying to protect you. So stay here. Stay with my people. I've commanded them all, you know, not to touch you, not to basically treat you like a Moabite prostitute. And pull out extra grain for her. So he's going over the top, not just leaving the stuff that falls anyway, but pull out extra for her. So in a sense, he's going out of his way to help this foreign woman. So these are all things we see in him, his character of being exemplary in his generosity and his grace towards her and his willingness to see her as included in Israel and to protect the foreigner and the alien and the widow and all these things that are the heart of God. So, and by the way, come dip your bread in the vinegar. Just a little word there. Chometz.
Can you give me a verse?
Chometz.
Oh, I've got it.
Where have you got it?
I think
it's in 11. 14.
Oh.
Verse 14. Well, when he says, come when you're hungry, dip your bread in vinegar. So chometz is the word for vinegar. But there's something else we call today hummus. And if you backtrack, hummus is actually the name in Arabic. And if you go into the etymology, what it would have been in Biblical Hebrew, it would have been chometz. So it's a homonym, same exact way of saying it. And I think that dipping her bread in hummus makes more sense than dipping it in vinegar. So we also know that the chickpea is local here. We found one. Tavi, maybe you know more, but I know for sure we found a petrified hummus bean in one of the graves in this land in like 1300 BC. So it's been around a while, and it goes so perfectly with pita, which has always been the staple of this area as well. So that's why I'm pretty sure that the chometz here is not vinegar, but hummus. Okay. And Naomi, of course, is impressed with Boaz's generosity. When she comes home, she's got a ton of grain, and she knows that she's gotten special care to be able to get that. And she reinforces what Boaz said, you better stick with these people because they're going to protect you. So again, there's this idea it could be dangerous for her in another field. Okay. So, good, we still have some time. Now we're going to enter chapter 3. Do you remember chapter 3? We're going to have to read it quickly, and then we'll talk about it. Okay, where were we reading? Back there? Oh, over here. Go ahead and read first chapter 3.
Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall we not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now Boaz, whose young woman you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be, when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. And she said to her, all that you say to me, I will do. Your turn.
So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. It happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. He said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative. Then he said, may you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. Now, it is true I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning.
So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized. And he said, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. He also said, bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out. When she did so,
He poured into it 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then he went back to town. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, "How did it go, my daughter?" Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her and added, "He gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, 'Don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" Then Naomi said, "Wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens. The man will not rest until the matter is settled today."
Interesting. How did it go? It literally says, "Mi'at." Who are you? Okay, so chapter 3. Is this the kind of advice you would expect a mother-in-law to give her daughter-in-law?
No, not now.
Why not?
I was going to say, because you're making your daughter, well, you don't know how it will end up. She
right, it's dangerous.
Up.
It's
yeah,
dangerous.
Dangerous.
It's like, why don't you take a shower, put on makeup, wear a miniskirt, and be like,
the whole
go
stuff
out and
that
just
you
see
said
what
about everything you said about the Moabites.
Exactly.
And here we are saying, basically, go and seduce this guy.
Yes. Okay. So, what is chapter 3 doing in the book? Does it need to be there to tell the story?
Yes. So it's setting it up.
Well, to make the point the author's trying to make, yes. But it doesn't need to be there. If you're just telling a story, you could go from chapter 2, she needs a kinsman redeemer, to chapter 4. You know, Boaz goes up to the gate, negotiates, done, you have a happy marriage, everyone's taken care of. And you have the line of David, how great. But why is chapter 3 there?
Well, her obedience is pretty remarkable.
Okay, obedience is pretty remarkable. Definitely, she is. Her whole motivation is to obey her mother-in-law. And her mother-in-law, Naomi, says, you know, I'm doing this for your good, but essentially it's for her good too. Because if Ruth can marry a guy, then they're taken care of. And then they don't have to be fighting for survival all the time. So, so Ruth is definitely pictured as doing everything Naomi says, no matter what the cost for her. It might mean her reputation is bad, it might mean all kinds of things, but she is willing to do it again, to give up everything to help this older lady. So that's definitely there. From the author's perspective though, why do you think chapter 3 is so important?
It's got to do with the kinsman redeemer and rights in the community.
Okay, kinsman redeemer and rights, but that was in the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 4. You wouldn't have to have chapter 3 there.
It shows Boaz's character.
Shows Boaz's character. There you go.
But it also shows, if you like, on a deeper level, the power of redemption.
Power of redemption. There you go.
I mean, if...
Oh, that reminds me, Gemma. Who is a person? Somebody, I don't know who it is, said, if you're going to mature or to prove that you have kind of matured to the stage of overcoming a temptation, what do you have to do?
Face the temptation.
You have to face, you have to be put in the same situation and say no.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So this is essentially what chapter 3 is doing for us. Because you all know Ruth is a Moabitess and she's a foreigner and she's a seductress, you know, that's a stereotype. So now we are going to put her in the same situation as Lot's daughters and see what happens. And so she's obedient to Naomi. She comes down at night. And notice, to set the stage, it's in the Golan, where you already know it's dangerous in the daytime. How much more so at night? Everyone's camping out in the field. Nobody sees anything. Everything's dark. Find where Boaz is sleeping. And then what? Wait until?
He lies down.
He eats and
drinks.
Okay, so again, Lot. They got him drunk. I'm not saying Boaz was drunk, but it does say his heart was merry. So let's say he's tipsy. He's well-fed. He's had a little bit to drink. So in this context, an average person may make mistakes, right?
Yeah.
So like you're tipping the scale actually against them to prove their character. Even in this context, they are high character. So, and then uncover, I keep reading feet. Magilotav, or the place of his legs and feet are the same word, essentially. But if you ever try to act out this story, and you're doing it with a bunch of people who don't know each other, I've done this because I've taught Biblical Hebrew doing acting out stories, you'll find it gets very uncomfortable. And you start to feel what this actually meant, to kind of take off the blanket in the area of his feet and lie down. I mean, what's going on? There is a lot of tension, and there's supposed to be a lot of tension. And then he says, oh, a woman, you know, what are you doing here? And
he doesn't actually say that. He says, who are you?
No, it says he's noticed a woman, though. And then he said, who are you? Yeah, it's pitch black.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing.
But he noticed she was a woman.
Oh, yeah, that's
and
true.
All of a sudden she was there. What's this woman doing here?
Yeah.
And so then basically she says, symbolically, marry me. Put your wing over me, kanaf, which is an allusion to marry me. And so then Boaz, even after drinking all this wine and being in the dark and knowing she's a foreigner and he could do anything he felt like, he wants to do everything according to how it should be done, including protecting her reputation. And so like, oh, leave just to make sure nobody thinks anything about you and nobody thinks anything happened tonight, leave before anyone else sees you, because we're going to deal with this all above board and exactly the way it should be done properly. And he doesn't do what Lot would have done. He doesn't do what she doesn't do what Ruth's ancestor does. And notice he says, because everybody knows you are a what?
Woman of noble character.
Woman of noble character. That is exactly our Proverbs 31.
Eshet Chai.
It is Eshet Chai. So we know Boaz is a Gibor Chai, and Ruth is an Eshet Chai. So they have to be put in the same experiment and prove their character to us, the reader, for us to see, like, wow, they are exceptional people, and yes, I can't judge them according to the stereotype, or particularly her, but also the way he is treating her. And so we are very impressed with their character now, and now the story continues, where Boaz goes up to the city gate, and, oh, that's funny, my Net Bible has John Doe. Boaz went up to the village gate, I'm in reading Ruth chapter 4. There along came the guardian whom Boaz had mentioned to Ruth. Boaz said, come here and sit down, John Doe. In Hebrew, it's ploni almoni, which is when you're not wanting to put their name. You put anonymous person. Why would they not want to put the name there?
Because he chose not to redeem.
Because he chose not to redeem. So actually, the author is very careful not to shame him and his family forever. Mm-hmm. Just say, okay, anonymous. Because in the big scheme of things, it's a good thing he didn't redeem her, because Boaz was supposed to be that person. So he's anonymous. And, you know, if you're going to do any business, you go to the city gate and you get the elders together. He's got 10 people. And he says, okay, look, there's this field you can redeem. And the guy's like, oh, yeah, I'll redeem it. And he goes, and you get a Moabitess as part of that package. He's like, oh, no. I would destroy my own land if I did that.
But is it because she's a Moabite or because she's supposed to produce children and then he loses?
We don't know, but the way Boaz, if you look down, it says, when you acquire the field from Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the wife of our deceased relative. So we don't know what point this other guy was, oh no, is it like one more mouth to feed and all her descendants, and if I spread my wealth too thinly, you know, it's going to destroy my own stuff? Maybe. Or is it also because she's a Moabite, like, I don't know about that, it'll tarnish my name. Maybe both. Boaz, the interesting thing is, Boaz is pretty confident that mentioning Ruth is going to cancel the deal.
Yeah.
Did you notice that?
Yeah.
Because at first he presents a deal, there's this field, do you want it? And the guy's like, oh yeah, I'll take it. And by the way, you get Ruth too. No. So it kind of shows you, again, the stereotype, maybe. And obviously the fact that it's one more person and more mouths to feed. I'm unable to redeem it. And then we have the sandal ceremony differently than it's described in the law, where in the levirate marriage, you know, she takes off her sandal and spits on it, and it's all this shame thing. And here, it's actually the sandal is just a proof of transaction. So that's an interesting little twist on the law.
Sharon, is also the fact that he has to maintain the name of the dead with his property, like he'd be not only getting extra rounds, he's getting extra rounds that aren't under his name.
Right. It would be given away. Well, according to levirate law, the first son would carry the name of the deceased. After that, it could be his own again. But yeah, but the firstborn does inherit property, right? Yeah. A double portion.
So it would be taking away.
However, he's gaining a field, so you could say that field would go to that firstborn. So in a sense, you're not gaining anything, right? You're gaining a field, but then that's going to go in to the firstborn inheritance.
To maintain the name of them with his property. It's his property.
Yeah.
So he'll get maybe other, he'll have to divide it between more kids.
Right. So you're really just helping someone out. You're not getting anything.
Interestingly enough, at the end of the book... Go back to the shoe a second.
It's Boaz's name we hear anyway, not Elimelech or Mahlon. The shoe?
Yeah. It says, to me, it's in mine, it says, to confirm anything, one man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was confirmation in Israel. So it's part of the deal.
That's what it says.
We don't know, is it the guy... Is it the John Doe taking off his shoe and giving it to Boaz? You said it's not normally the woman. You said something in levirate law, it's the woman.
Well, I was referring to the levirate law.
Well, never mind, I don't want to go down there.
Yeah. It's a little complicated. Since we're out of time, I was actually going to skip it. But if you go back and read the levirate law, it's a woman, and she spits on it. And she says,
Where did you find that?
I'll give you the reference, but it should be in anybody's footnote. Sorry, I didn't write it down, but I'll give it to you afterwards.
Don't worry.
So since we are out of time, Ruth is a wonderful book because, of course, she is the great-grandmother of King David, right? So it's kind of really amazing that King David, as you know, this King Judah and all the stuff we have conceived of him, he also has foreigner in him. And yet it shows this picture of redemption for the foreigner who joins himself to the God of Israel. And this whole story is very significant because if you read Matthew's genealogy, Ruth gets mentioned there. And I would say that's on purpose. There are four women mentioned in Matthew's genealogy, and he didn't need to mention any of those people, just like chapter 3 didn't need to be in the book. But he does because he's trying to remind you of certain things. Don't judge by what things look like. Don't judge Mary by what she looks like. You know, in Ruth's case, it's similar to Mary. And if you notice one more cool thing about Ruth, it says that God gave her pregnancy. Look in chapter 4, 13. The Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Normally, the formula when you're describing these, she conceived, gave birth to a son. But here, it literally says in Hebrew, God gave her pregnancy. So it's just a little bit weird. It catches your attention, your ear. And so it almost makes it seem like a special thing. And I wonder if that's also behind Matthew's thinking, because when he mentions Ruth, he wants you to go back and read the story of Ruth and to think about that in light of the genealogy. And then when you read this, God gave her pregnancy, things aren't as they seem, it'll help you see, oh, maybe the same thing for Mary. You know, God gave her pregnancy, things are not as they seem, you know.
Why? Well, that's amazing.
Anyway, so all you people who are not from Israel, be encouraged that God's salvation plan is for everybody. We are included and grafted in. And we can look at Ruth and Boaz as examples of high character. And even when other people are judging us wrongly, you know, you can still prove your character by just consistently showing your loyalty to God and to other people who are disadvantaged. So, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you, Sharon.